The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone, where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO abduction phenomenon. Our guest today is Joseph Foster. Quartermaster Foster was on deck when he saw three objects careening at 3,500 miles per hour over his Coast Guard cutter, the Mellon. Just 10 minutes later, he learned of the sinking of a Soviet submarine carrying three armed nuclear ballistic missiles and torpedoes lost with all hands. The mysterious objects had approached from the same direction, east-northeast, 800 miles away. The 1968 incident prompted the CIA, Project Arizona, to investigate and raise the sub. After all, it was during the Cold War. Foster is a retired information technology, electronics, and communications project manager. Joe led technical support teams as a contractor for the Department of Defense, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the aerospace industry. These included an automated gun sight with a heads-up display, an advanced waste-to-energy system, and the promotion of an innovative data storage technology using a crystal as a high-capacity storage medium. And we're happy to have him with us today. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me, David.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So, actually, you've been witness to four major UAP events beginning as early as childhood. Can you tell our listeners about your personal experiences with UAP phenomena?
My first UAP, of course, back in the day, they were called UFOs.
Right. We have to learn to change that now.
Yes, it is a new nomenclature. My first UFO incident was probably around 1954. And I was living on a farm out in the Hamptons, out in East Hampton, with my parents. And one night during the summer, 54, they took my sister and I to a drive-in movie theater in Bridgehampton. And the theater had just opened up. And we were sitting there watching the movie. And then from above the screen was a bright white light that made zigzagging motion at high speed and disappeared behind the screen. That was my first knowledge of anything strange in the sky. I remembered it like it was yesterday. And interestingly, over the years, the description has been used for other objects that have been seen at various times. Interestingly, that particular object was in the direction of Brookhaven National Lab. And of course, Brookhaven National Lab has been one of the top U.S. government nuclear labs. So that was the first event. There would be others. There would be another one event before I went into the service, and after the service, there were a couple more events that were worthwhile noting. So the next event took place in 1958. Again, my folks and I were living on a farm, this time in Colts Neck, New Jersey, not too far from Naval Ammunition Depot Earl. And the farm was a beautiful farm, and it was adjacent to what we call the Navy Road or Normandy Road, which was the road that linked the ammunition storage depot with its, the naval pier facilities about 13.2 miles away on Raritan Bay. And there was a daylight sphere. It was a silver sphere lazily flying along the length of the road, which was about 200 yards away from my house. And it was flashing red and white lights. And it was at after sundown, but it was still like daylight because it was dusk. And it was a very, very well, you know, well viewed object. There's a synchronicity to all this that I think is very important, being that that happened in 1958. Well, you don't really think about other things or even know about other things that were taking place at that time. Mm-hmm. However, there were a number of things that, starting with 1958 for me, and not ending until 2002. So the synchronicity included my sighting, the initial sighting, and then two other events that seemed to be unrelated, one was separated by less than a month, and the other one was separated by several years. But they were all tied into the UFO incidents, especially along the Navy Road. Now, the Naval Ammunition Depot, for years, all the locals, we locals knew when they were moving non-traditional munitions along this road. There were four crossing points. And each time a truck or a train was carrying something of interest, they would have squads of armed Marines that would stop the flow of traffic crossing the road. And they would not open the road up again until that vehicle, whether it's a truck or a train, passed. So you always knew when they were moving interesting munitions. But I think that's also the reason that we had so much activity over the years around that area, because it was nuclear related. Okay. There's much more to that story, which I can go into a little later on. Then after that, for me, the next events were three. When I went into the service, I went into the Coast Guard. My first duty station was actually shipboard duty on the Coast Guard cutter Mellon, named after interesting Christopher Mellon's ancestor, who was Secretary of the Treasury. My ship was a Secretary class cutter that the Coast Guard named their 378s after. So that's a little synchronicity and a little oddity, I think, mm-hmm. at least from my perspective. But on board that ship, my first Ocean Station Victor patrol was July and August of 1969. And Ocean Station Victor was a geographic location, a 10 square mile location in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, roughly halfway between Hawaii, Honolulu, and Japan. We were a navigation aid. We had a doctor on board for search and rescue. And we also were able to track aerial and shipboard traffic. And during that patrol, during the Apollo 11 mission, we actually had three objects flying over the ship. And that were reported first by radar, air search radar, and had them clocked at 3,500 miles per hour. They were flying out of the northeast and heading on a southwesterly course. And it took them directly over the ship. And there were 14 of us on the bridge. It was shift change. I was on the mid-watch going on. And we were relieving the other watch that was getting ready to be relieved. And we all saw the objects as they flew over the ship. So we had visual sightings. We also had the radar corroboration. And it was formally reported. Mm-hmm. Now, I was never debriefed, so I feel it's perfectly all right to talk about this. But there were two other events too. But I'm going to stop right here and give you a chance to
to say something. Listen, Joe, I was going to ask you, speaking of not being debriefed, were you ever approached by any officers and spoken to about these incidents and received any orders pertaining to them?
No, that's the strange thing. And I've been talking about this for some time. I had spoken with people on board my ship that were either peripherally involved, and none of us were ever debriefed. Now, that has a lot to do, I believe, with the captain of my ship. My captain was the senior captain in the Coast Guard. He was a senior 06, which is one step below admiral. Being a Mustanger, he was never going to be promoted to admiral. But he was probably the most seaworthy skipper that I've ever come across in my life. Mm-hmm. And he was also a type person that you would trust with your life. You had to, actually. But if he said jump off a cliff, I figured there must be a very good reason for it, and I'd probably end up doing it. So, and he never thought it was important enough. And also, interestingly, he spent 30 years or more at sea. It's my conjecture that if you spend any time at sea at all, you're going to see things that fit the model of UFOs, USOs, and other phenomena that can't be explained. I was only on board that ship for 20 months, and I had three valid sightings. You know, I had the one during the Apollo mission. I had one during Morning Stars, which was a daylight sphere that flew right directly at the ship. And we had also some type of a USO, or unknown submersible object, that while we were holding swim call right off the coast of Vietnam, it went right underneath the ship, whatever it was. And I don't know what it was. It was just a large black object that was teardrop shaped. And we were anchored at the time. We know that how deep it was, because it had to clear the keel at 18 feet. And we also knew the length of it, because my ship was 378 foot long. I'm 44 feet above the waterline, you know, because I had anchor detail. And the object, the way it sailed underneath or cruised underneath the ship, we were able to get the size of it about 100 foot long and about 35 foot wide. So it was too big for most whales that I'm aware of, except maybe possibly a blue whale. And it did not fit any shape of any known submarine. A miniature sub that at the time, and that's the first thing we thought of, is a miniature sub.
Were you able to see it visually, or did you see it through radar or sonar?
No, it was, like I said, we were anchored about 3 or 4 miles offshore at the time, and we were waiting for movement orders to go to our duty station, which was at the mouth of the Sonadoc River. But until our orders came in, the captain authorized swim call. So, being anchored there, the day was overcast. It was a gray day. The water, there was a 3 to 5 knot wind, so you had a little bit of chop to the water. And, of course, the water was not the clear blue of the South Pacific. We were in coastal waters, so you had a lot of mud in the water. So the conditions were not conducive to seeing anything other than a shape that was 18 foot below the surface. We knew it was 18 foot below the surface because it cleared the keel at that depth.
When you say swim call,
mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Do you jump off the...
Well, if you weren't on duty,
mm-hmm.
Captain authorized swim call, a third of the ship's crew remained on duty in case they had to move it or whatever. I was on the anchor watch. I was a quartermaster navigator at the time. And so I couldn't go swimming, but the rest, 2/3 of the crew that wanted to, whoever wanted to, were able to dive off the main deck, swim over to a rubber raft, and climb back up onto the main deck on a cargo net. It was recreational.
Yeah. I mean,
my longest patrol was 57 days without touching land.
Wow.
You know, so you looked for your recreation where you could find it. And the captain was a pretty good, he was a pretty good head about that. So he, if it was possible, he would authorize swim calls.
When you finally got off the ship, you did you wobble?
Yeah. We actually got like seasickness on solid land.
Oh my God, I bet you. Okay. So did you ever, speak of USOs, mm-hmm. did you ever see a USO go into or come out of the water while you were out to sea?
No, that I never did see. Also, I've got to clarify something. There were a bunch of things that kind of were run together, and from a timeline and everything, it was probably the way I presented and the way it was copied down. The K-129 was mentioned. Mm-hmm. K-129 was the Soviet ballistic missile submarine that sank about 1,000 miles from Hawaii, from Honolulu. And that particular incident took place in 1968, March of 68. In 1968, there were a total of 4 submarines around the world that were lost. It was a bad year to be on a submarine. The Russians lost the K-129. The Americans lost the Scorpion. And then the French lost a submarine, as did the Israelis. The Israeli submarine was sunk by an Egyptian destroyer. But that K-129 is an interesting story. And 99% of that story comes from a video that was put together by the CIA. And it was actually released in, I think, 1977 or 78. And basically, it's the story of the Glomar Explorer, which was a ship that was built by Howard Hughes. And its cover story was it was going to be mining magnesium nodules off the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. And interestingly, 16,000 feet of water, which is also the depth of the ocean where the K-129 sank. Now, the K-129 was a ballistic missile sub, like much like our boomers. It would be on station for about 60 days. Off the coast of Oregon and Washington. It would be relieved by another ballistic missile sub, and it would go back to Vladivostok or whatever port was the Soviet port for that submarine. They'd be in port for a period of time, training and whatnot, and then they would go back on station. The difference about the K-129, the K-129 was a Gulf II class diesel submarine, of which I think there were 4 of them made. There were ballistic missile subs. They had 3 ballistic missiles in the conning tower, and the range was about 1,000 miles. So interestingly, where it sank was 1,000 miles from Honolulu. And instead of heading on a course back to its duty station, which would have been off of Oregon or Washington, it was making a beeline towards Honolulu. And that's where it sank. The reason they were able to find where it sank is the U.S. Navy had deployed these very sensitive listening devices all over the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. And sound travels great distances in the water.
Right.
So basically what they were able to do, when the submarine broke up, when it got to a certain depth, it was crushed. It was like a beer can being crushed.
Oh, my.
Well, that sound was picked up by several of these sensors. And they were basically able to triangulate to where the sub went down. So the U.S. Navy knew within probably 5 or 10 miles where that sub was.
Mm-hmm.
Soviets, on the other hand, had no idea. So for some reason, the CIA hatched the plan that they wanted to raise that sub. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to why they would want to do that. Very expensive proposition, especially without GPS and without a lot of technology that we have today. Now, my tie into this, at least what I believe, and this is where it kind of gets skewed a little bit. 1970, the Glomar Explorer tied up, and I'm 99% sure it was the Glomar Explorer, not the Glomar Challenger, although they both were involved with this event. tied up in front of my ship in Honolulu Harbor just before I set sail on my second ocean station. And this ship was, like I said, it was a very unique ship. It had derricks on it. It was about 700 or 800 feet long. Beautiful ship, brand spanking new, with a helicopter flight deck. So we saw it up close and personal when we took our Liberty launch to go into Honolulu. The interesting part of this story is, according to the video, and it's called Project Azorian. If you want to look at it for yourself, Google Project Azorian.
How do you spell that?
Pardon me?
How do you spell that?
A-Z-O-R-I-A-N.
Okay.
Okay. And that was the code name for the project. What happened was the New York Times leaked the project, and then they had to cover fast because raising another country's warship is an act of war in of itself.
Mm-hmm. And
this ship was carrying 3 ballistic missiles on it with nuclear warheads. It also had nuclear torpedoes on it. And who knows what else. But the story has it, or one of the stories was, that the ship was on a course that nobody could explain, and the Russians didn't know where it was going. And a submarine that goes kind of goes rogue for one of two reasons. Either it's defecting, or it's going to commit a rogue action, act of war. Now, interestingly, these submarines, these Gulf II submarines, were being sold by the Russians to the Chinese. They had already transferred 3 of them. This was the 4th and was going to be, I believe, the last that was going to be transferred.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thought has it that somebody tried, the reason that submarine sank is because it caught fire and sank. And they think that possibly somebody was trying to illegally launch one of those missiles. Problem is, it's like our nuclear approach. You need basically a 2-key approach to launch a missile.
Right.
Okay, and there's 2 acts you have to do. One is to reprogram the targeting, and the other thing is the actual launch. If you put in the wrong code for the launch, it'll self-destruct. At least that's the story that has it. And I think what maybe was happening was the Chinese... Go ahead.
I was going to ask you, what will self-destruct? The entire sub or...
The missile.
The missile. Now, the missile self-destruct.
That would destroy the submarine, too.
There you go.
Okay. I'll tell you, submarines are very dangerous, even at the best of times.
Yeah.
But people, I don't think, realize just how dangerous it is. Or how much power these submarines could carry. That was a diesel-powered sub, which was pretty archaic, but it was still capable of launching 3 missiles.
Wow.
Okay.
I have to take a moment. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I have to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with the retired quartermaster for the Coast Guard, Mr. Joseph Foster. And let me ask you, Joe, you're talking about the sub and the fact that it was, if you raise another country's sub, war sub, it's an act of war.
Mm-hmm.
But we raised this Soviet sub, correct?
No, not really. We've raised part of it.
An act of war? Did we commit an act of war at the time?
I think technically, yeah, it is.
Uh-huh.
Here's the thing. The reason that the CIA did an excellent job of creating a video, I'm not going to say it's 100% accurate.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it probably isn't. But I think from a public relations standpoint, they were very, very respectful of the. They pulled up several bodies,
mm-hmm.
so the crewmen, and they gave them full military honors, burial at sea, the whole bit, and they recovered the bell, the ship's bell, I think, and they returned that to the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the I think what was happening here, nobody knew what that sub was doing, And the interesting thing that we do know about that sub is that when it left port for the last time, it had an extra 10 people on it. Okay. Now, a diesel submarine, by definition, they're not called pig boats for nothing. Okay. Everything that's on there is absolutely necessary for the mission. And you add to a crew of 85 or 90 men, another 10 people, you're putting a strain on all the resources, oxygen, food, water, sleeping capacity, all that stuff. So those 10 people that were on there, nobody knows why they were on board or who they were. You have to understand the geopolitical situation at the time was fascinating. Russia and China were actually having a hot war between themselves on their border, their common border. Yet here is the Russians turning over submarines to the Chinese. Interestingly, one of the thoughts was that this was a false flag attack, that somebody was going to launch a nuclear missile at Honolulu. And that would be World War III, but the Chinese would have been blamed for it, not the Russians. Okay. Uh-huh. Now, the Russians, they had a hardline government, very hardline. KGB guys, and they wanted, you know, they were ready for a war with the United States at the time. So that is one scenario that is a possibility. There was also a movie that was made about this, and it was very, very close to that scenario where rogue KGB agents commandeered the submarine at gunpoint, forcing the captain and the executive officer to give their, you know, the keys and do the whole thing, and that the captain was actually the hero. He was either Lithuanian, I think he was Lithuanian, and he's the one that put the wrong codes in so that they wouldn't start World War III, basically. That
Sean Connery, right?
No, that was Search for Red
October, yeah.
No, this was, I can't remember the name of it, but it had two good actors in it. Duchovny was the KGB guy, and the ship's captain was another great actor, Academy Award winning actor. But the story diverted at the end. I mean, it changed slightly.
Always.
Okay, now there's two points that I really have to make.
Please.
One, first of all, my tie into this was seeing the Glomar Explorer in Honolulu Harbor. And then also that patrol, when I went out on patrol, Ocean Station Victor is not a military, it's not a place of military, great military importance. It was a navigation area and search and rescue. But we ended up playing a strange game of cat and mouse with a Russian spy ship. And we had no clue what they were doing on Ocean Station Victor or why they were paying so much attention to us. We were just sitting there minding our own business. And during this event, there was another object, another submarine that showed up. It was an American submarine that was now playing cat and mouse with the Russian. So you had these things all going on, and we were only a couple hundred miles from where that submarine went down.
Okay.
And before it was actually discovered and raised. It was raised in 76, I believe. Now, the last bit of interesting tidbit of information is, number one, the Russian Navy has had run-ins. Their submarines have had run-ins, as have ours, I believe, with USOs. Okay? Mm-hmm. And because of these run-ins, a lot of things happen. There have been challenges. There have been dangerous activity supposedly taking place. So was that submarine lost to a USO? Could have been. But I can't say one way or the other. All I can do is speculate as anybody else. The other interesting point of information was after the fall of communism and glasnost and perestroika, a high-level Pentagon team met with their counterparts and now the Russian Federation. And that incident was actually brought up and apparently discussed. No minutes came out about it. The only thing was the takeaway that was agreed to by both teams was that they would never speak of the K-129 or the Scorpion ever again. because each one was blaming the other side, but also each side probably knew what the truth was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that was, I mean, the whole thing is a mystery wrapped in an enigma. Okay.
Right. Right.
But at least we have an inkling of what happened, and we can speculate and say, without too much getting off into the science fiction aspect of it, there is some fertile ground for conjecture.
Okay. So these incidences, or this incident especially, involved nuclear weapons, correct? Mm-hmm. And this is when and where this object, whatever it was, underneath your ship was sighted.
No. Well, no, that was right off of Vietnam.
Okay.
I mean, that was in probably less than 150 feet of water.
Well, was there an incident where there were nuclear weapons, nuclear powered sub involved, where UFOs were involved that you were witness to?
No. Hmm. No, I mean, that would, I mean, it's a need to know type of basis. I mean, I was a Coast Guard cutter. I was dealing with naval situations when I was in Vietnam, because when we enter a war zone, the Coast Guard is no longer, I was under the Department of Transportation.
Hmm.
But in time of war, or when you're change of operations to the Navy, that's when we're paid by the Navy. Everything we do is Navy at that point.
Right.
So there's a need to know. I mean, did we have a need to know about any nuclear submarines operating any place? No, none whatsoever. So it would have been an accident to find out about it.
Yeah. But do you agree with most ufologists that extraterrestrials are interested in our nuclear weapons and our nuclear power plants, et cetera?
Yeah, and I've got a whole, and I do have a lot of information firsthand. Right around here. Yeah, absolutely. Any place that there's nuclear weapons, nuclear power plants, ships at sea that carrying them, or propulsion systems, they are all privy, or they are all, they're all in scope for being visited by objects that are, they're going to show curiosity about them. That I'm sure of.
Is it curiosity? Because some people worry that, oh, they're interested in our nuclear weapons. They're able to shut down our nuclear weapons. They're able to turn on our nuclear weapons. This has been demonstrated, okay? Are they trying to tell us, in your opinion, are they trying to tell us something? Or are they messing with us? Or both.
No, I don't think they're messing with us, but I don't think they have any great fear of us either.
No.
Because you're right. They can do what they will, and that becomes problematic for the military. Mm-hmm. All the militaries of the world. We spend trillions of dollars on the highest technology we can get our hands on, but much of it is being shown to be, not much of a challenge for somebody that has something a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that we're seeing, I think you would have to say, is not just a little bit better, it's quite a bit better. So now right here in this area, okay, let's come back to Monmouth County, New Jersey. Okay, we have Fort Monmouth. And Fort Monmouth was the Communications and Electronics Command for the U.S. Army. However, what people don't realize, part of Fort Monmouth had Camp Evans, which is in Wall Township, highly classified area for years. During World War II, it was actually part of the Manhattan Project, where they designed the fuses for the atomic bombs. They also, we had Nad Earl, Naval Ammunition Depot Earl, where they store munitions for the Atlantic Fleet. And ships come and go, picking up, and that includes submarines, torpedoes, whatever else, the ordnance that's stored there is transferred to and from ships. So we have that. We also had McGuire Air Force Base, which was the Air Materiel Command, where they had the largest collection of nuclear-armed Bomark B anti-aircraft missiles. One of them actually blew up in 1960. the warhead didn't blow up. It ruptured and scattered plutonium over a fairly large area.
Gee.
They're still cleaning it up to this day. Okay. Mm. It's probably the worst nuclear accident in New Jersey. That was at McGuire Air Force Base. Interestingly, McGuire Air Force Base, also in 1978, George Filer reported, and he was on site. He was a security briefing officer at McGuire Air Force Base. An MP at Fort Dix shot and killed an alien that died on an unused runway. Mm. Years later, I was an athlete. After I got out of the Coast Guard, I became an athletic director at Fort Monmouth, working at the field house. And I made friends with a lot of soldiers. And we also had the local RAs from the FBI office that used to come and work out at the gym. Mm-hmm. And one of these gentlemen, a very gregarious fellow, very friendly, always joking around, nice guy, a lot of fun to be around. One night in January of 78, he comes into the field house about 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night. And he was exactly the opposite of the way he normally was. He was as white as a sheet. And he came in and I even asked him, I said, you look like you saw a ghost. What's the problem? He said they killed somebody on a military base. And then he never said another word about it. And that was January of 1978, the same time that George Filer reported the alien was shot on the runway. Yeah. Now, this took place, you know, at the same time, but it was years later that I found out about the alien. Because I was checking all the newspapers. I thought some anti-war protester was sneaking into Earl to blow up one of the bunkers where they were storing nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. But it was never reported. Okay. That's synchronicity. That's synchronicity.
As a side note, I co-authored a book with George Filer. He told me about that incident. He was on this show quite a while ago. I've got to get him back, but he's so soft-spoken, I have a hard time hearing him. You know? At any rate, let me take one more minute to, so we don't have to interrupt again, to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with retired quartermaster for the Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard, Mr. Joseph Foster. He's had a couple experiences with UFOs and submarines that get squashed like beer cans and yuck. terrible. But you also, to my understanding, have had personal experience with what you thought might be extraterrestrials. Is that correct?
I had one experience that I can't explain. I mean, whether it's a paranormal, whether it's a religious event, I can't say one way or the other. All I can say is that there was something that would fit the model of some type of action. Took place. I had just come back from Vietnam. I was no longer on the ship. I was now going and I was a shift supervisor at Amver, which is up at Governor's Island, New York. And that winter when I came back home, I was able to live at home with my parents in their house between shifts. So one night I came in and I went to bed around 11 o'clock, I guess. And I was off for 48 hours. So I went to bed. I went to a bar. I came home about 11. There was a blizzard taking place, and the wind was blowing. The snow was coming down. There was already over a foot of snow on the ground. And I came into my house. I went upstairs, washed up, and then went to bed. Now, my room was, you know, a regular bedroom, not a lot of stuff in it. It was kind of a Spartan room, but it was pitch black, and I had dark drapes on three windows. And the only illumination in the entire room when the lights were out was the clock face on my alarm clock. I had one of those cheap electric alarm clocks. Mm-hmm. And so I went to bed, I went to sleep, and I woke up at 5 minutes after three. I remember the first thing I saw was the alarm clock. It was 3:05. And I'm laying there, and now I'm coming wide awake. The room is still pitch black except for the clock. And all of a sudden, up in the corner of the room, where the walls came together and the ceiling and a closet door, there was a soft neon light that was about the size of a baseball. And so I'm looking at it, and I say, well, that's interesting. And the light grew from the baseball size to about the size of a basketball. It was a soft neon light, but it lit up the entire room. The entire room is now fully illuminated. And the room became toasty warm, the most comfortable warmth, especially with the wind howling outside and everything. It was a perfect feeling for a cold winter night. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, the sense was of extreme peace. And I was afraid to move because I didn't want to break the spell. It was just a perfect thing. Everything was perfect at that moment in time. And of course, being about, I guess I was about 21 at the time, just came back from Vietnam. Bad time, 1971 now, it's not a good time. Vietnam was a very painful event for the entire country. And the sense I had was all my friends that didn't go, we were all on different wavelength. And, normal feelings when you're that age, well, where am I going from here? What is my next, what's going to be next steps for me? Mm-hmm. And so I have a lot of questions, a lot of concerns about, where you were going. And all of a sudden in that moment, every concern that I ever had dissipated. And the feeling was, don't worry about it. Everything is going to be fine. It's all going to work out. And from that point forward, that was how my life has been ruled. I don't worry. I don't plan on things. But the rest of my life, it was one thing after another, happened in a synchronicity, and it was exactly what needed to be done at that time. Mm-hmm. Whatever I needed to be was where I was. Wherever I needed to say, whatever I needed to say, it came out the right way for whatever reason. And I ended up with some of the most interesting jobs going forward that I couldn't have planned it. There was no way I could have ever planned my life. I want to become a doctor. I want to become a rocket scientist, which I did want to become at one point. But it was like everything just fell into place. It was one thing after another, and college had nothing to do with it. Matter of fact, if I really focused the way my parents wanted me to, I would have been dead ended someplace. It would have been contra to that epiphany that I had that night.
Yeah.
So, I mean, was it alien? No, I don't know whether it was. Was it an abduction experience? Yeah, it could have been. But if it was, boy, I suggest everybody go through it.
Yeah. But a lot of people have said that, and I've written a book where I compare religious experiences to aliens and other dimensional. And any Christian, anyone who believes in an afterlife believes in other dimensions. And quantum physics tells us that there are many other dimensions.
Yes.
I think it's 12 of which we already know, and probably billions of them more.
Yep.
So why shouldn't there be aliens coming through other dimensions, spiritual beings coming through other dimensions, God, Jesus, Muhammad, whatever, through other dimensions. Mm-hmm. So I would say, regardless of what experience you had, it was other dimensional, yes?
Yeah, from a science perspective, I would say it would have to be. And we now know that other dimensions do exist. No matter even whether it's string theory, bubble theory, multiverses, they may all exist at the same time, creating the veil that we get to view it through it right. from time to time.
Right.
Which I find exact. It is not contra to any religion.
No.
It's a matter of fact, science and religion to me are synonymous. I mean, we're going to have faith until the last secret of the universe has been divulged to us.
Yes.
You know, because you have to. I mean, you have to believe that there's something more than what we know right now.
I hope there
is. If we know everything, we're going to be God.
Okay. Yeah. And anybody who says they do know everything about it, just nod and smile and walk away.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
I've met those people. And I just, okay, you know, but at any rate. But there, I saw you or heard you, I forget now, on another interview where you talked about an incident in your crib.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was, again, a little about my family background. My mom was born and raised in Elizabeth, New Jersey. She also had a measurable IQ of 160. Communication with my mother was next to impossible. I found that we operated on separate planes.
She was way above you then.
or to the side or wherever. but the thing was, and she was very, she had a full ride scholarship to Cooper Union. She fancies herself an artist, although I think a true critic would probably argue with her at that point. but a good woman. I mean, she was a very, very good mother.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, she met my dad, and my dad was in the Navy, and after the war was over, he got out, and they met, and they fell in love, and they ended up getting married. Now, my dad was from coal mining country in Pennsylvania. And he didn't want to, carry on the family tradition of working in coal mines. And my mom didn't want to spend the rest of her life living in a city. So they both decided that they were going to become farmers. Now, it's laughable because you have to spend almost a lifetime learning how to be a farmer.
Yeah.
And they were both starting from scratch, starting their life, not with a lot of money or anything. And but they moved on to farms. I was born, and they were living on a farm then, and they moved around quite a bit. Mm-hmm. My father was a journeyman farmer, and so we ended up when we first moved to East Hampton. I'm going to say I was about 2.5, going on 3 years old, and we were living on a farm by the Gould family of Wall Street fame. The family was out there, and they owned a small farm, a small dairy farm. And we lived in a small cottage, a farm cottage. And behind the cottage was a field. On the other side of the field, there was the Long Island Railroad. And on the other side of the Long Island Railroad, there was miles of nothing. Potato fields and farmland. And so what happened in my crib was located in my parents' bedroom, at the foot of my parents' bed, with the baseboard at the base of their bed, and the headboard was away from it on my mother's side of the bed. And I remember one night, all of a sudden coming wide awake, and I was standing, leaning against the headboard of my crib on the left side, and I was facing catty corner to the crib and the baseboard. And on that side, there was this creature. And the interesting thing about it was a clown. I mean, it was a hideous clown. And the funny thing was, I had no fear of it whatsoever. There was no sense of fear. There was a little bit of curiosity. And it was just, I was staring at it and it was staring at me. And had big black eyes, the whole thing.
Right. Right.
It had makeup on. It had like clown makeup on. And that entire event took maybe 10 or 15 seconds. Then I remember absolutely nothing. I didn't remember waking up in the morning. I didn't remember anything other than that 10 or 15 second blast of, you know, the
whatever,
staring at this whatever. And years and years later, I'm sitting there and said, you know, if that was a nightmare, there was nothing nightmarish about it. It was, you know, but, and I remember looking around, I had the entire room, the room was painted in my memory. And so I started drawing pictures of it. And I went to my mother, and my mother is still alive. I said, you know, years ago, remember when we were living here, blah, 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 blah. And I described to both my mother and my father what the room looked like, where the dresser was, the color of the room, you know, what the bed looked like, you know, where my crib was. And they said, no, that's exactly the way it was. Now, but again, what it was, I can't tell you. I mean, I don't have, at least that I'm aware of, I don't remember being taken away in a spacecraft. I don't, you know, I don't remember anything other than that staring session.
Right. Well, abductees, if I may interrupt, abductees often relate the fact that they see what they think is a clown or an owl. Mm-hmm. Or a deer, something with big black eyes, okay? But mm-hmm. something that they're familiar with. And this is how they present themselves in your mind so that you won't be afraid of how they actually look.
Right.
And so especially for a child, a clown would be apropos, don't you think?
But not a horrible, I mean, this clown was something out of a Chucky movie.
You're kidding.
It was not an Emmett Kelly type of clown doing funny things. So
maybe
whatever
it didn't know how to
conjured up was not that.
Maybe being alien, it knew children like clowns, but it didn't know how to present itself as a clown.
Well, they probably presented for the guy that wrote Chucky.
Even before Chucky was written.
Well, here's the interesting thing, though. My mother, when she was a child, she had a very, very strange event. And she also said that there was something that happened to her head. And I'm sitting there and said, oh, boy, you know, what's this? She said, no. Look, and if you feel her head, there was like a tremendous indentation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, you know, and she talked about a couple of other things, but, you know, I sat there and I couldn't process it to the point where I could make anything intelligible about it. I figured, well, it's just another communications breakdown because, you know, she operates on a different plane.
Mm-hmm.
So, but like I said, and that went on, and they also had another story that before I was born, they bought a small farm in, New Albany, around New Albany, Pennsylvania. And she had a story about something strange about a cow chasing them.
Mm.
So I don't know. I mean, again, you know, you take everything with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
But she did have some interesting insights throughout her life. So.
Did she ever mention seeing UFOs or?
Not UFOs, but she did. She did once, but she described being taken away in what I don't know if you know what the old milking machines look like.
Oh yeah.
Well, it's a kind of a stainless steel tub about the size of a bucket,
and right.
It had a lid on it, and of course the suction, you hook it up to suction, and that's what puts right. the milk in. Well, she said that she was taken into an object that looked like that. She described it as a milking machine type of thing. So, but again, I'm sitting there and say, oh, that's great, Mom. I'm glad to hear that. Just do me a favor. Don't tell any of my friends.
But abductions seem to run in family lines. So you think maybe it's possible?
Yeah, I do. And there's a reason I believe that more now. Than I did before. My daughter was born 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And She was an interesting child growing up. And at one point she was about 8 or 9 years old, and I was going to drop her off at the beach, or I picked her up at the beach, and the car had sand all over the back, right? And we came home, and the next day I was going to take her back and drop her off at the beach. But she got up that day and she came down and she's gouging at her arm. Mm. And she's gouging at it. And I said, "What are you doing?" And the arm was bleeding. She said, "There's something in here." And she scratched until she got this, and it was about the size of a mustard seed.
Mm.
And it was black. It was charcoal gray. And now she was saying that ever since she was a little kid, very young, like 3 or 4 years old, there was a woman that used to come into her room. But we never, you know, kids all have night dreams. They, you know,
right.
You know, the monsters live under the bed or in the closet or whatever. Right. But when she gouged this thing out, she gave it to me. I'm looking, I said, "Oh my God." I said, "That looks exactly like one of the implants that Lear was."
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly like it. So I'm looking, and we're in the car now. I'm holding it. She's in the back seat. I said, "Okay, I didn't want to lose it." Wrong move. I said, "Hold on to this and don't lose it." Dropped it on the floor with the sand and the gravel all over.
Oh.
Yeah, but she had a hole that she dug. It was right out of her arm.
So you never know. You never know.
Well, yeah, we'll never know. So.
Joe, where can our listeners go to learn more about your life, your work? Website?
I have a website. It's www.millennium.oss. That's millennium.oss.com. If you go out there, I have some Zoom sessions out there. I don't have everything. I mean, I was in the process. I have two chapters. Tim Beckley, before he passed away, his last book, I have a chapter in there. And also I have a mention in George Filer's, his most recent book.
Mm-hmm.
That came out, I guess, about 2 years ago or so. So,
very good. And,
I'm sorry?
I said very good. Very good.
But anyway, they're welcome to send me email, or you can put that information out there. I sent a slide deck, one of the slide decks that I use from time to time, and it has some contact information in it. And so if you look that over, you may have more questions or whatever. So
okay.
We're only covering a very small piece of the stuff that I've come across in my travels.
Well, maybe we can have you on again at a later date. What do you think?
Absolutely. I would love to come back.
Make notes of what you didn't cover, and we'll cover it then.
Sure. Okay.
Mr. Joseph Foster, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and maybe we can do it again another time.
David, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. Please check out my website, which is ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. And stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again on our new day and time, which is the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. That's the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m., when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.